I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Danica Rome, member of the Virginia House of Delegates and the first openly transgender woman to serve in a state legislature. She's joined in conversation by Raquel Willis, Communications Associate for the Transgender Law Center. And now, join Maggie Grabmeier on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Danica Rome and Raquel Willis.
Hello, everyone. Happy Coming Out Day. Today, National Coming Out Day was founded as a way for queer people to challenge homophobia and transphobia by being brave, coming out, and taking up space. The idea is that by coming out to our family, friends, coworkers, and acquaintances, we're creating new allies and helping to build a more accepting world for others in the LGBTQ community. Though a lot has changed since 1988, coming out is still a big deal to most people, and we as a society still have a long way to go in terms of rights for LGBTQ people. Here with us this evening to talk about the legacy and impact of Coming Out Day, what it means to come out and be out in this current political climate, are two inspiring community organizers, Virginia Delegate Danica Rome, our country's first openly transgender state legislator, and Raquel Willis. And Raquel Willis, activist and national organizer for the Transgender Law Center.
What's up, JCC? Yeah. Look, you got me for one night. You gotta give it to me. Yeah. Now we're getting somewhere. It's good to see y'all too.
So yeah, thanks everyone for showing up to this amazing event. We're here celebrating National Coming Out Day, which is such an important, amazing day each year for our people, right? For our queer and trans folks, across this nation. And so I'm Raquel Willis, and I am so excited to be here with Danica. And just to give a little background, Danica is a 33-year-old stepmom. See, she already fact-checking me. 34-year-old stepmom, lifelong resident of Manassas, Virginia, and a former award-winning, let's be clear, award-winning journalist and editor. Okay. But what we possibly know Danica for the most is her impressive and devastating victory in 2017, where she was named as the first out transgender woman to be elected and to serve in the state legislature. Now that's powerful. So how do you feel, hearing all of that, right, and thinking about your journey and being here in this moment?
I'm on East Coast time. I feel tired, yo. I feel, we're going to return to this refrain a few times tonight, but from the outset, everything that you were just saying about my story, my team and I, and it was an inclusive victory. We won because of who I am, not despite it. We won because of our message, not despite it. We won because we overcame obstacles instead of falling flat when they were put in front of us. That is something that I hope y'all take to heart today, that where it's like, how do I feel about it? Is like, well, I got a job to do, and I know what it's like to go, and when you're applying for jobs under a male name, to get called back for interviews every 2 to 3 applications, and then get a job offer out of every 8, 9, or 10, and then go 1 for 35 in a search under a female name. Like, I know what that's like. I know what it's like to live without health insurance for 2.5 years, to be unemployed, to be uninsured, driving a $324.92 Dodge Shadow, kicking off a campaign. And then that sucker broke down, you know, like 2 months in, and then replaced that with a $1,500.98 Toyota that then bid it 3 months after that. And now I got my 98 Honda for $2,500. So as you could tell, rolling in them delegate bucks, that $17,640 salary that we have with that sweet, sweet per diem of $203 a day when we're in session.
But balling on a budget.
Yeah, right. But that's one of the things, though. Like, when you elect people who understand what it means to have to live paycheck to paycheck, who understand what the first of the month means, and that means a little something different for some of us than it does for other folks, right? And that when we come from this perspective of, we know what it's like to come out of a, you know, an ER with a $2,000 medical bill saying, how am I going to pay for this? And a year and a half later, you finally pay off the last bit of that. That's the sort of perspective that allows you to legislate with people in mind who are not already at the top of the ladder, who don't already have everything handed to them, who are decent, hardworking folks who need that hand up. And you understand how to preserve that dignity of people while you're doing it, to be respectful and to understand that it's like we're all in this together, and that it's not my job to get to the front of the line and tell you, how come you're not up here yet? I got mine. Where's yours? My job is to get to the front of the line, extend my arm back and say, join me. And what can I do to help? That's my legislative approach, because it's germane to where I come from in Manassas. It's germane to my backstory. And that, above all, what really makes me feel good about everything in the last year is I'm still the same person now as I was on January 2nd, the day before I got in the race last year. I haven't changed a bit. Loud, you know? So, yeah, there's that. I've had to give up some stuff along the way, but I'm still me. And that's what I hope you all can take out of this here, too, is that, again, you can succeed because of who you are, not despite it.
So, yeah, you just really talked about your humble beginnings and the realness, right? The authenticity that you brought to your campaign. And I think that that really was what resonated, right, nationally and internationally, when folks heard about your race, was that they saw a piece of you in them. And I remember actually watching a video that you were in, and you were actually talking about a young girl named Clara. And I think in the spirit of Coming Out Day, if you could just share what that impactful moment was when you met her and talked with her mom, I believe it was.
Yeah, the story that you're referring to is when a parent who lived about 3.5-4 hours away from me dropped me a line on the 7th, or no, about the 10th day of the campaign, somewhere in the first 2 weeks, saying, hey, I came across a news story about your campaign, and then I showed it to my kid, who read it over 3 times after having jumped out of tried jumping out of a second story window to end it all, because at age 10, this little kid didn't feel that there was going to be anyone who ever understood what they're going through and couldn't relate to anyone and was bullied and tormented. And, you know, there's a lot to that backstory. And Ma said that, like, when they read over that story 3 times in a row, line for line, kid looks up and says, she's just like me. And Mom says, she's just like you. And then she says, so how does she do it? How does Danica put herself out there? And her Ma says, because Danica knows who she is. And she's not afraid to be who she is. And that little kid said, well, if Danica can do it, I can too. And I fast forward to just about a month or so ago. And I was in a place nearby. That was in Roanoke, what I was discussing before. But I was in Salem this time around, which is right next door. And I'm sitting in the library. I had just knocked on doors for Carter Turner, who's running a special election in the 8th House of Delegates race. And by the way, if he wins, we'll be at 50-50 in the House of Delegates, so show him some love, y'all. And, God, you have no idea what that means. You really don't. And I was, like, knocking doors for Anthony Falcavento, who's running for Congress down there. And so I get done. I'm just waiting for my phone to charge. And this 15-year-old trans girl walks over to me. And she starts talking. And it was clear that she was autistic. And, like, that's cool. I got a lot of, you know, autistic people in my life who I absolutely love. And so, like, I know how to, like, speak, you know, empathetically, understanding. You know, just slow it down and make sure that you're not, you know, putting them on the spot. And just, you know, just listening. And so some of the questions that she was asking from anyone else might have been, like, really, you know, like, invasive. But I was like, no, like, it's cool. I'm like, I get it. It's cool. And, like, you know, asking me about my hormones, like, right when we start and stuff. I'm like, all right, it's all right, all right, all right. We got this. Like, but then as we go through, she says, I've never met another trans girl before. And I was like, well, hi, my name is Danica. It's nice to meet you, too. And she says, can you be my mentor? I'm like, honey, I live 200 miles away, sweetie. I got 83,000 people to take care of back home. I can't be that person for you, but I know a lot of folks in Roanoke who could, from the ladies and gents of the Blue Ridge, and I got some of their contact information, and I did an event for them earlier this year. Why don't you go talk to them? Because there's a lot that those folks could learn from you, and there's a lot that you can learn from those folks, because you're never too old to learn, you're never too young to teach, right? And I don't know what's happened since that moment, but now she knows that she's got people in her community who she can aspire to look after, who she can aspire to learn from, who she can aspire to emulate, to ask questions and get those sorts of answers from people at home who maybe even just a few days earlier she never even knew existed. And when I went down to Southwest Virginia to campaign for 4 days for some folks on the ballot this year, it's a long way from home. And at the same time, this is like really rural Virginia. This is old Virginia. And that doesn't mean it's bad Virginia. It just means it's rural Virginia. It just means that when you go there, you didn't know that in 4 days you were going to have over a dozen people come out to you. But they did. And if anyone thinks that LGBTQ people don't exist in rural Virginia or rural America, we do. And I mean, like, I live in the exurb suburbs, so it's not for me to say. Part of my district, I got a little rural, around the west, a little bit. Italian speak, un po. Piccolo. But it's really important to acknowledge that when you are vulnerable enough to be visible in the first place, that you are setting the template and the example for other people to find their courage and vulnerability to be visible. And what does that do? Well, I'm not the person who convinced every person, the ladies and gents of the Blue Ridge, to have come out, especially those who are older than me anyway. But because they are out, now they're going to make it a little bit easier for that girl from Salem. They're going to make it a little bit easier for the next kid who's going to follow her too. Because now they have some that we didn't have in the towns that we grew up in. We didn't have out trans elected officials. We didn't have trans elected officials. We didn't have anyone in a position of power looking out for our rights when we were growing up in the South. We had people who were inherently trying to make it harder to be who we are. And when that's the case for you, then the example that you learn is that you are wrong. And I'm not talking about your opinions. I'm not talking about your worldview. I'm talking about you as a fundamental human being that you learn and you internalize early that who you are is wrong, which is why things like conversion therapy and all that other BS exist in the first place. Whereas the reality is, wait a minute. You're trying to fix something that ain't broken. There's nothing wrong here. What's wrong here? I'm being the person who I know who I am. And if you're religious, then I'm being the person who God made me to be. If you're not religious, I'm being my authentic sense of self. And there's no one else here who can tell me who I'm supposed to be because I'm the only one who will ever understand what it means to be me. And so to bring it all full circle, to talk to a little kid from Roanoke, to be able to pick up that kid in the eye and look eye to eye and say, you can be president someday because we just won. And we just won this together. To tell a little 15-year-old in Salem that, hey, there's some people in this community who are really, really good folks, and they're gonna have your back if you just reach out to them. And for me to be in front of this audience here, where I know I'm not close to home, but I do know that we have that one common thing here, that first-person perspective that is unique to each of us, but at the same time, we have a shared worldview that goes with it, that unique understanding and experience of what it means to come out in the first place, to have been that scared. And why were you scared to begin with? It's because you were internalized that someone would take it the wrong way, or that you would disappoint someone else. It always came back to someone else. But maybe for some folks here, there was denial in the first place because of we, again, have internalized it to say, this isn't who I am. Or maybe we had to go through a process and we had to use sexuality as a stepping stone to get to gender identity, right? That's very common for a lot of us. Or maybe you're just trying to figure your own stuff out, and that's okay. Wherever you are in your life, that's okay. And my message to you is welcome, and I'm glad you're here because of who you are.
Yeah. So going back just a little bit to talk about inspiration, right? And so you talked about, you know, the isolation, right, of being in rural areas or near rural areas and being in the South. But who are those kind of folks who were an inspiration? And they don't have to be LGBTQ. And it could also be your inspirations politically.
The people who I started gravitating toward when I was a teenager, from high school getting into college especially, were women who fronted heavy metal bands. That was really where, like, and they were all cisgender, but at the same time, I didn't know any trans people in metal. And I mean, like, some of us do exist, but, you know, like, when we were growing up, who were our role models on television, our trans role models? They were on, like, Jerry Springer and Mari and stuff like that. It's just like, that's not who we're trying to emulate, right? That's not it, because then at that point, it's all about the show. And at that point, it's about putting people on not a stage like this to have a discussion about our lives and public policy and, you know, the things we all share in common, but to make a spectacle out of it, right? And then what do we have in the movies? And it's like, and it's movies we like too, that even I like. You're like, you know, Ace Ventura, the trans woman is the villain, right? And then you've got Silence of the Lambs, trans person is the villain, right? And then it's like, you know, even like the wholesome comedies, like, you know, like Miss Doubtfire or something, it's just like, that's not even a trans person, just like, you know, a guy who's cross-dressing and having to understand the difference of that, right? And so as you realize that we had no representation in media, and if you don't think you have representation in media, you sure as hell don't have it in politics. So, and when we have so many tens of thousands of elected officials in the United States, and we realize that right now we're at an all-time high for trans representation of 14 people. And last year we had 6 or 7. We lost one and we gained one this year. So where does that take us, right? So for me, I would see, like, the vocalist of Arch Enemy, former vocalist now, Angela Gasso, this woman from Germany who just came out like a lion when I first saw her in August 2002 over at Jackson's, West Springfield. And she just came out ferocious and crushing with this band that could play so fast and so technical, and they were so good. And that album, Wages of Sin, just completely changed my perspective on music. It was so good. And then a few months later, for the second time in 1 year, another album completely changed my perspective on music when I heard Lacuna Coil and the album Comalize, and Christina Scabbia, who sounds nothing like Angela, but she has her complete own thing going with this beautiful, clean voice and a lot of power and stage presence and windmill and headbang and all the other cool stuff. And then it turns out, oh, wait, her and her band are really nice people. And when people who you look up to are really nice, you might see them on tour 50 times. Not exaggerated.
You're listening to Danica Rome, member of the Virginia House of Delegates and the first openly transgender woman to serve in a state legislature. She's joined in conversation by Raquel Willis, Communications Associate for the Transgender Law Center, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
My late teens, I did find some joy and happiness. It was on a stage. Well, it's actually in front of a stage, except for a couple times I got on, then I got to playing the gig. But here's the thing about, like, when you want to emulate those folks, and then you get to perform and everything. Well, when I was performing at first, I was still closeted. I was still, like, I had come out in college. The first time I started coming out as trans was once I got to college, because I was 350 miles away from home, and I felt that there were enough of, like, the women who I was meeting in my freshman year who I could come out to who were cool with it. Mm-hmm. And not just cool with it, but celebrating it and saying, oh, can I do your makeup? Can I do this? Can you put it? Yes, yes, and yes. And, hey, let's go out to this club over in Buffalo, or let's go to Ithaca or something. Wow, I can do this now? And you're experiencing all the sensations and everything, but it's really wrapped up, super condensed, 3 hours that you have to express yourself as you, and then you better make sure that no one sees you getting changed or anything else on your way, because, dear God, as a trans person, you learn how to change in your car. And it becomes really, really, really common where you're just having to pretend to be one person in front of other people because you think that's safe, as opposed to always being yourself in front of everyone. And if there is anything that was absolutely obnoxious in my life for 20 years, from the time I realized I was trans by the time I was 10 until, you know, like I came out to my family when I was 30, it was thinking that I needed to be someone else and trying to keep track of here's who knows, here's who doesn't, here's how far out I can be, here's the edge of flamboyance or femininity that I can express, and here's where I need to dial it back, because I'm afraid that, well, my guy friends might think I like them or something like that, where it's like, no, I don't. Have you ever looked at yourself? Good God. Don't flatter yourself, honey. Jeez. You know, and some of them, and then, like, but then, like, there are other friends who I was like, I very, very much want to come out to you because I want you to know that it's safe to be around me. Like, a lot of my women friends were, I wanted them to understand that no matter what my presentation was in front of them, they could always talk to me as they would talk to any of their other girlfriends. They could always express themselves however they wanted to, and it was safe in that moment. And that, to me, was also really important to make sure that I was coming out to these people, but not to these people. Mm-hmm. God, that gets tiring. That gets really, really tiring. And the way that I've described gender dysphoria is it's like a hand around your throat that slowly closes over time until you can't breathe anymore. For some people, it hits pretty instantly. And by the time they're a kid and they realize it, it's time to transition. And for other people, you put up with it, you endure it, you try to figure out other ways around it, you try to live, you try to bury it, you try every other thing, and it never goes away. And so no matter what shows I would be performing as I could be on stage emulating my best James Hetfield from Metallica, and I love doing that, I still wanted to be performing as Christina Scabbia. I still wanted to be performing as Angela Gossow. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, even though that's someone, you know, and James Hetfield, who I just like look up to and absolutely adore, it still isn't me. And in fact, one of the things you learn in music is they are them. Your heroes, those people on stage, let them be themselves. You go and be you. You can be inspired by them. You can have their pictures up on your wall, on your posters, right? But you got to go and do your thing. You've got to go and deliver for yourself. Don't try to be them. Be inspired by them to be the best version of you, because in that moment, they're trying to be the best versions of them. That's the thing to take out at that moment. And when I finally got the courage in 2014 to start presenting as her, I remember the last show that I ever presented as male as, right before, it was like during the ice bucket challenge. And I was, I was already well into HRT at this point. I was like probably 8-9 months into HRT. It was summer 2014. And I had done this whole video presenting as her, looking good doing it. Everything was great. Photos were good. And then I changed my clothes to get ready for stage. And there was this one gay guy who was working at the door who, I mean, just like in the world of twink is like the full twinkie. You know what I mean? Just absolutely just like teeny adorable guy. And he just goes, "Why did you change?" And he's so disappointed. I don't know. Why did I? And that's how I felt from that point. I was like, you know what? You're right. Why did I change? Here you are, being yourself at the door, not even having a chance to do the stuff that I'm going to be doing on the stage tonight. And you have more courage to be yourself than I do when I'm on stage with my band about to bulldoze an audience. That sounds pretty damn fake on my part now, doesn't it? Because no matter how I felt during the day, I would always go to bed still feeling like, how come not her yet? And I would always wake up the next morning feeling the same way, and then I would get through my day. And no matter how much partying I would do, you know, and I got attacked in the campaign all time last year for my band, right? I mean, like, got attacked for everything, so I really don't care what anyone has to say about my music career. Really don't. It's cool. It got me to Scotland and Northern Ireland. It was worth it. And at the same time, I also realized that for most of those first 6, 7, 8 years, I still pretend to be someone else. But then at the end, for those last couple years, to just be herself, well, now I'm learning how to be her on stage. And God damn, if that isn't awkward as hell when you're trans. And going through all of that sort of stuff, whereas I wish I had figured that out when I was 21 so I could have been a beast at 30. But instead, by the time I was finally secure enough, I was finally at a point where I could be that person who I hope that closet case in the crowd who came to see my show looked at and said, I can do that too, because if Dan can do that, so can I. And it was so funny. I always wanted to be in, you know, like in a magazine, like, you know, my guitar and stuff. And I just imagine if I was in high school and someone had made fun of me for it, and I'm like, yeah, the only magazine you're going to be on is like a gay magazine. Well, hell yeah, I was on the front cover of Metro Weekly with my guitar. And you flipped it over to the centerfold portion. It's me headbanging my hair up, holding my guitar and going, I just became the poster that I always had on my wall as a teenager. That's a cool feeling. Hell yeah, I was in a gay magazine, and I hope you pick it up. It was like, what a cool feeling that is. And own that. Because that's finally the place where I'm like, yeah. Yeah, this was how it was meant to be. And then after I won the election, the only other metal person who was in the House of Delegates who I was aware of at the time, turns out there's a closet metalhead who's in the House of Delegates too, came to my office one night just and was just like, heard me just like blast and thrash because like everyone else was gone for the day. And I'm always like the last person to leave the General Assembly because I actually work and do my job. I listen to good music while I'm there. So... But no, I'll answer constituent emails like all night. It's just like what I'm there in Richmond to do. And so guy comes up and we just start talking music. I was like, yeah, and you know, this band, they covered Arise by Sepultura. And he's like, oh, Sepultura. I used to listen to them when I was listening to Celtic Frost. This guy is buttoned down as all hell. I mean, like straight out of central casting for who politicians are supposed to be, unlike yours truly. And so like I go, you know Celtic Frost. That's only one of those bands you know when metal's a lifestyle, not just music. Go on. So all that aside, I guess the real bottom line on that is, oh yeah. So the guy who he had just retired, his name is Dave Albo. He sends me a package in the mail after the election. So I opened this thing, and it's a copy of Premier Guitar Magazine, kind of like Guitar World. And he says, and he writes this note in it, and he's like, turn to page 19 or whatever it was. So I turn to this page, and sure enough, in this guitar magazine, there's my picture holding my guitar, and Brendan Small, the creator of Metalocalypse, has a tweet in that's printed in this magazine. And it just says, Danica Rome just elected as a transgender transgender shredder who to Virginia House of Delegates. That's metal as f***. And I read the note that was attached to it, and it says, Danica, I always wanted to be featured in guitar in Premier Guitar or Guitar World. You beat me to it. I'm so jealous. And I was just like, yeah. But for anyone who would have ever given me crap about, like, oh, you would be in the gay magazine, hell yeah, I was. And I was in Premier Guitar, too. So that was also cool. So go live that dream. Oh, my
God. So what was the final straw for you where you were just like, yes, I need to run for office? This is an avenue to create change.
When I got called and asked to run for office. No, so like what tends to happen in politics, and this is actually completely true, is it's not in every single case. Very often, the data shows that women are recruited to run, and men take initiative to run. Well, like a lot of women, I was asked to run. So August 4th, 2016, I got an email from the 2015 Democratic nominee from the 13th District who said, hey, I'm not going to be able to run again. I got to move out of the district. Would you consider running? You'd be a really good candidate. I didn't respond to the email. Next day, I get a phone call from the recruiting chairman from the state Democratic House caucus named Delegate Rip Sullivan, who called me and said, hey, have you considered running? You'd be really good. So I talked to him for a while, met him up in person. And after I talked to him for an hour, I said, all right, now that you've talked to me for an hour, what's your take on my strengths and weaknesses? And he goes, well, your public policy knowledge is off the charts. Your energy is off the charts. You talk too much. Mom's from the Bronx. I'm an Italian extrovert. We all have our flaws, my dear. It's like, you ain't fixing that one. And so the other part of that as I'm talking to him, he's like, well, you know, I'm more concerned about you being in a metal band than I am about you being transgender. And here's the funny thing with that. Like, as soon as I got that recruitment phone call, like, what issues would you run on? Immediately I said, fixing Route 28. Why? Because my mom's been driving up and down that damn road for 39 years to get to her job near Dulles International Airport. And no major change has happened there between Yorkshire and Centerville, aside from one overpass getting installed, since the mid-80s. And meanwhile, my county has added hundreds of thousands of new residents. And so our infrastructure did not keep up with our development. And that's a huge problem in a high growth area, because then your roads are over capacity, your schools are overcrowded, and that puts a strain on water infrastructure, on fire, EMS, police, you name it. Every bit of the social fabric that we have gets burdened by that when we don't have adequate existing infrastructure in place already there to support it before it comes online, because very often we build first and then we have the supporting infrastructure to come in afterward, and that can't be how government works. So I took my 9 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks of reporting experience as the lead reporter of the Gainesville Times from 2006 to 2015, when I authored more than 2,500 news stories about the greater Prince William County area, as in my lifelong home area of 34 years, and said, well, you know what? I've got the public policy knowledge to do this. I know the issues that are important. And I've been my now predecessor's constituent his entire tenure in office. At that point, before I ran, it was 24 going on 25 years. I knew, and I had interviewed him for 9 years. I knew his record inside and out. I knew his record in some cases better than he did. It was just true. And what I decided on that was, all right, I'm going to stick to the issues. And I know that as a trans person getting into a race where you're going against the self-described chief homophobe of Virginia, that the national media narrative would always be about my gender. That would always come first. But the local narrative had to be about public policy that was important to quality of life issues affecting the people of the 13th district, traffic, jobs, schools, healthcare, and equality. And instead of being vague about it, being really specific about it, fix Route 28, not just transportation, fix Route 28, find a cost-effective way to extend the Virginia Railway Express out to Gainesville from the Manassas Airport, Broad Run Station, and fill the office vacancies along Manassas Drive, Manassas Park that have been there for the last 9 years. Raise teacher pay so it's not the lowest in Northern Virginia. Expand Medicaid to cover 3,700 uninsured people in the 13th District. And by the way, spoiler alert, we on May 30th voted to expand Medicaid to 400,000 Virginians across the Commonwealth. And the governor signed that into law. So come January 1st, it'll actually be about 3,800 of my now uninsured constituents who are earning up to $16,754 a year will actually finally have quality affordable health insurance. That's huge. That's fundamentally game-changing, because when you are uninsured and you know what it's like to just try to stick it out instead of trying to rack up more debt, yeah, you can literally save lives doing that. And so that's incredible. It's awesome. And that became one of the big issues that I was campaigning on, because the entire Republican caucus last year had voted against Medicaid expansion. The entire Democratic caucus voted for it. Well, this year, well, we added 15 seats, and guess what happened? All the Democrats, you know, who all the Democrats voted for it, and then we got 19 Republicans on board too, because elections have consequences. And remember, and this is huge. If you can't change your minds, you change your seats. And if someone tries to take your rights away from you, then you take their seat. It's that simple. But it's not as simple as I'm in the race now. Let's go in. There's a lot you got to know. You got to be well qualified. You got to know the issues. You've got to have that understanding of your district and the people who you are running to serve. And once you do have that understanding and you can speak about that, then at that point, you make sure that people understand the contrast in the race and that you are focused on the issues. Don't get lost in the sideshow. Don't get lost in discriminatory BS. And one thing that I would say last year all the time, and I never attack a constituent, so I'm just saying this basically as historical fact for what I said on the campaign last year, was Delegate Marshall's legislative priorities are more focused on where I go to the bathroom than how you get to work. In one sentence, I did four things. One, we addressed the trans issue. Number two, instant contrast. What is my top public policy issue? Number three, if you single out and stigmatize your constituents, that is the antithesis of serving your constituents. That is the antithesis of constituent service. Thus, LGBTQ issues are constituent service issues, the same way that women's issues are, the same way that transportation is, the same way that criminal justice issues are, the same way that every other public policy issue is a constituent service issue. I framed all of that as my constituents need this, because my trans constituents need their transition-related healthcare to be covered by health insurance companies and their health insurance plans, because transition-related healthcare is not optional. It's not elective. It's not cosmetic. We are following our doctor's orders. And that for my gay constituents having access to IVF for a lesbian couple who live in Gainesville, or having access to PrEP, that is important parts of their healthcare. LGBTQ healthcare is healthcare. Thus, it's a constituent service issue the way that I framed it. And I would look at that and then I would say, look, for very particular groups of my constituency, this is important for them. But what unites the most people, and the way that I would say this is never, I'm trans, but I really care about this. And I said, no, I'm trans and I care a lot about civil rights. I'm transgender and I care a lot about water infrastructure. I care a lot about replacing traffic lights with overpasses. I care a lot about making sure that you can get home from your job in time to pick up your kids from daycare without being charged $5 a minute for every minute that you're late after 6:30, which one of my constituents had to deal with. And when you can frame the argument as everything that you're doing for your constituents, who can ever attack you for that? No one. When session ended this year, we got out. Every single one of the bills I had filed this year were either constituent service bills, bills that my constituents asked me to carry, or they were four government accountability bills that I carried based on my 10 and a half years of professional journalism experience. And no one attacked me for the bills that I authored and carried. Instead, guess what the one bill they decided to attack me on was? Danica Rome was the chief co-patron of a bill to raise your health insurance premiums by covering selective sex change surgeries. And you shouldn't have to pay more for your health insurance to subsidize, and it was, quote, unnecessary liberal lifestyle choices. Well, that's funny because you attacked me, the trans woman, for this, even though you didn't attack the author of the bill, a cis woman who wrote the bill and submitted the bill and carried the bill this year.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Danica Rome, member of the Virginia House of Delegates and the first openly transgender woman to serve in a state legislature. She's joined in conversation by Raquel Willis, Communications Associate for the Transgender Law Center. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
So, apparently, the Republican Party of Virginia's fundraising team thinks that they know more about gender dysphoria than my psychologist, my endocrinologist, and my voice therapist, all three of whom are doctors. I think my doctors know a little something more about gender dysphoria and the trans experience than any member of the Republican Party of Virginia's fundraising team will ever want to know. So don't even pretend to give me that BS. And when they do that, they are trying to make it harder for my constituent in Manassas Park to have her health insurance needs covered. Mine are covered right now. I'm a state employee. I got a great health plan for first time in 2.5 years. But she might not have them. Thus, I need to take care of my constituent in Manassas Park. And if you ever come and attack my constituents, you have to go through me. And then you have to go through my district-wide support, my county-wide support, my commonwealth-wide support, and by the way, my nationwide support too.
Internationally known.
Woman of mystery. It's like, here's the thing. I'm a reporter, so I still talk like I'm in a newsroom. Like, yeah, some people might try to, you know, get on my case and do that, but it's like, I'm being genuine and authentic. And genuine and authentic to me means speaking truth to power bluntly, forcefully, and letting discriminatory politicians know that their views have no place in our America.
So we are definitely in election season, right? I mean, we're kind of always in election season.
So welcome to Virginia. We have elections every year. Right. By the way, I'm up in 2019.
And so obviously, you know, we're in a very tumultuous time politically, you know, the Trump era, right? We have so many of our folks under attack, you know, people of color, queer and trans folks, immigrants, Muslim folks, all types of people. And one of the biggest conversations that kind of always comes up is around, does my vote matter, right? And so thinking about...
had the majority of the House of Delegates came down to one vote that was not cast in the city of Newport News last year. A tied drawing out of a fishbowl gave the Republicans a 51-49 majority instead of 50-50 dead even. If anyone says my vote doesn't count, I have my friend Shelley Simons for you to talk to. And by the way, she's running again in 2019 because she knows that she can win this next one. But I'm just saying, if you ever think that, one, I am hate to break this to you, so I'm going to say this in my nice, most decorum, professional tone possible. You're wrong. And number two, it's nice if you vote. It's even better when you vote and you knock on doors and you bring out other people to vote along with you. Get active. This is not a time for us being passive. And one of the things that I said in the General Assembly this year constantly was, I do not accept despondency. Replace despondency with defiance. I don't even like saying I'm part of the resistance. I'm part of the defiance. Because when you're resisting, you're inherently on defense. When you're defying, you are on offense against every horrible thing that has been projected to us in the name of what is good and what we know is right for the very people who we are either running to serve or do serve. constituent service comes first. Not singling out anyone, not attacking your constituents. And when you're the president of the United States, transgender people are your constituents and you don't attack them. Reporters are your constituents and you don't attack them. LGBTQ people, people of color, immigrants, whatever it is, all of those are people who you are elected to serve. They are your constituents, and when you attack one of them, you have attacked all of them, and that means you have failed at your job. And when a politician fails at their job, it is up to the public to kick their ass out of office.
Okay.
Go vote.
And, you know, I think that that conversation is, you know, it is hard, right? Because so many folks have felt that they haven't had their voices heard for so long, right? And it really does matter where you are, right? In some places, it is difficult to see the possibility of transformation through your vote. And I really appreciate you speaking to the importance of organizing. And so I guess if you could just, you know, share a little bit more about your commitment to community organizers and where you see that relationship between folks in office and folks on the ground.
So one of the things I'll point out is that when my campaign knocked 75,000 doors last year in a district with 53,000 doors, so obviously we had to go to a lot of doors multiple times, I wasn't going into Centerville to knock doors. I was going to my district. The only reason I was able to win was because hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people came out to knock on doors, to make phone calls, write postcards, and people who from all over the country, all over my state, all over my county, and all over my district came out to help time and time and time again. People who are here to all the way people who live two doors down from me. And I had on my campaign team, my paid staff, campaign manager, finance director, field director, four field organizers, two deputy field organizers, interns, and we were working with the coordinated campaign and their staff as well. I had an army of people who every single day lived, breathed, ate, slept, and dreamed that campaign. And it took their commitment and it took them staying on message, executing that their job and holding me accountable to make sure that I was doing my best job as well. Because if I didn't have my best performance each day, how can I ever count on my staff to do the same thing? I have to be the one who sets that example. The buck stops with you as a candidate and the buck stops with you as a legislator. It is so important that you take accountability for yourself because that allows you to hold up that higher standard to other, for other folks. And what that allows you to do is for all of those community organizing groups, and we had a lot of groups that sprung up in the district from Indivisible Nova West, Together We Will, to, you know, Rise District, to so many other groups, DC Unite Against Hate, who would come into knock doors. So many groups, so many people came into knock doors constantly. That was that real community atmosphere, that real team emphasis that we put on it, that I could have never have done all that on my own. But the Saturday before the election, we sent out different walk packets for every single targeted door that we had in the entire district in one day, that Saturday before. That's how you want a campaign. And we were only able to do that because we had the capacity and the human power to be able to do that because we had so many volunteers who came in to do it. And we had Get Out the Vote runs where we ran through our universe three times in the last 3 weeks of the campaign. 8-point victory right there. How many of those doors do you think were decided in the last week? Or how many of those voters do you think were decided in the last week because someone knocked on their door? Whole lot of them. Just last week, I ran into a self-described Republican when I was speaking at a HOA meeting who told me, person who knocks on my door is the person who I vote for because I know that the person is going to work hard. And turns out that one of the candidates I'm backing from Asses Park governing body, Alana Mensing, she had knocked on his door. She's a Democrat, and he's voting for her because she put in the effort when it was super hot during the summer. She's out sweating and hustling, and she earned his vote. I would never ask someone at the door, can I get your vote? Can I have your vote? I say, can I earn your vote? remember that part of it too, that when you're knocking doors for someone else, can they earn your vote? And because at that point, you're now letting that voter know that the voter is the boss and that that is something that the candidate has to aspire, and that that person who you are asking to vote for you is trusting you with their vote. They are trusting you with something that people have died for them to have the right to be able to do that. So you better take it seriously, and you better have a good message, and you better do the best job that you can possibly do when you're in office to keep that person proud and to make sure that they understand they are still your boss and you are here at their service. That is community service. That's constituent service. And it takes a whole lot of people believing in the message for you to even have that opportunity in the first place. And boy, you better be humbled when you get it.
You know, thinking about all that you have accomplished and all you have yet to accomplish, right? What do you think about your legacy? Like, what do you want your legacy to be?
Well, come January, there's a parking lot in Haymarket that for the first time, Haymarket's going to have its first ever commuter bus, because I fulfilled a campaign promise to vote for putting a floor on the Northern Virginia Regional Motor Fuels Tax. Really, really wonky way of basically saying that this big mistake that was made, this big glaring omission in a transportation bill in 2013 cost us tens of millions of dollars for the next 5 years, and we finally plugged that gap, and that that was something that I ran on. And now that we get that done, we have a $324,000 bus system, basically, that's going out to the western end of my district that will have four buses each morning going out to four different stops over in Arlington right next to Washington, D.C. And so that, for me, when I get to see those buses rolling up for the first time, I get to go, I helped do that. My vote funded this. That's really, really, really cool. And that's something that's super exciting. 400,000 people with health insurance. That's amazing. 3% teacher pay raise across the board this year because we brought home those federal dollars from Medicaid expansion that freed up so many state dollars that at a time when teachers are striking in Arizona and Kentucky and West Virginia, we didn't have that problem in Virginia because we preempted it. And we took the first major crack at the school-to-prison pipeline in a long time because we found out, the data showed us, and I campaigned on this. This was in my platform, and you can still read it. And that we needed to reduce the length of long-term suspensions in Virginia because it was you could be suspended for school and not be required to be educated for 364 days at a time. Whereas most states, it's between 45 and 90 days. 364 days you could go without an education. And instead, what we were able to do with this, what we found in the data was that in all 133 localities in Virginia, all 133 localities, that those long-term suspensions were disproportionately targeted toward black boys and disabled kids. Disproportionately targeted in every single one. And for us to be able to reduce that, except for under very severe mitigating circumstances, what that now tells us is that we're going to give a lot more people the opportunity to continue their education, even if they've made a mistake, even if they get they let their temper get the best of them one day, that they don't stop learning in that moment. And that the worst thing that you can do for a student who's having trouble in school is to strip education away from them at all in its entirety. To be able to take a whack at that, that's huge. The fact that on a unanimous vote in the House and the Senate, we are allowing doctors to write recommendations for cannabidiol oil. Now, look, a lot of other states either have, you know, we're at a point where some states have recreational marijuana. We have some states, well, a lot more states that have medical marijuana. Virginia, we've been behind on this for a long time. And one of my constituents, his dad just died from cancer a couple of weeks ago, and he had been asking me earlier in the year, hey, do you know when my dad might be able to get access to this because it would really help him out a lot? And I'm like, hey, man, we just legalized this, or not? Well, we just allowed it, and so these facilities will be getting built up in the next year, but they still have to go through the licensing process and all this other stuff, so I'm not sure. it's a damn shame that his dad had to die, and that any non, you know, prescription treatment that they were using, they had to go underground to get, you know? That shouldn't happen. Let's be more compassionate. Let's be more ethical. Let's just take care of people. And I think about another thing where we voted to allow localities to extend recess time to elementary school students, an extra 15 minutes a day. Imagine if you're that kid, you have 15 minutes to play each day. What 8-year-old's going to stay still for 8 hours a day? It's not going to happen. So we accomplished a lot of really good stuff this year on a bipartisan basis, which was good. And this year was also notable for what didn't happen. For the first time in my memory, and I'm a reporter, and I covered Richmond for a long time, first time in my memory that we had zero anti-LGBTQ bills introduced by any member of the Virginia General Assembly this year. Not one. Because when you defeat some of the people who introduced those bills, who co-patroned those bills, or who voted for those bills, that sends a pretty clear signal to those who will remain, who would still support those, that those bills are not only dead on arrival, but their elected careers could be dead on arrival too. Cool. And when we have a governor who made it very, very clear that he will veto any discriminatory bills, just as our last governor did too, well, we didn't have a whole lot of discriminatory bills to send him this time around. We had one really bad discriminatory bill that was targeted toward immigrants, but, you know, that was like 4 times last year. And so we still have a lot of work to do to make progress to pass pro-equality bills. We had 4 non-discrimination bills that I watched die in succession on party line votes, one after the next, after next, after next, in committee this year, subcommittee in the House of Delegates. So disheartening to watch my colleagues vote down my civil rights. And at the same time, I got to work with them, because right after that committee meeting got out, I had to go to another committee meeting where one of those members who was sitting on that panel who voted against my rights each time was the chair of that committee. And I had to stand at the podium and say, "Mr. Chairman," and present my bill. That is soul crushing. It hurts so much at that point, but you got to keep decorum, because here's the thing. You've got to be able to keep that respect for your colleagues, even when you vehemently disagree with where they stand, because you've got to work with them. And if you can't work with them, then you're not going to get your constituent service request filed and passed into law, especially when you're a member of the minority party. You have to work with other people. There's no person in Richmond right now who can get a bill passed without having bipartisan support, because we have a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. We have to have it. But the Republican legislature last year in the House of Delegates was a 2-1 majority. Right now it's a 2-seat majority. And elections are coming next year. Thank you so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Danica Rome, member of the Virginia House of Delegates and the first openly transgender woman to serve in a state legislature. She was joined in conversation by Raquel Willis, Communications Associate for the Transgender Law Center. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.